ZeroDebt100.com.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
This takes us to the final four of the Paracast. David Kaiser, our guest. I'm Gene. Chris O'Brien's with me. You're in the Paracast. I'm going to ask you kind of a far-reaching question here, which may or may not relate to everything. This renewed emphasis in some quarters of the political spectrum on what we didn't consider science, such as creationism, other things. Is there an anti-science movement going on, trying to conserve what we knew before and forget about what we know now and what we hope to know in the future?
I hope not, Gene.
Yeah, I hope not. I think there are, I think we can find tendencies like that. I'm not sure it's so much to sort of keep us from discovering new things. I don't think that's what's driving it. I think it's politics like most politics. If people don't like a particular outcome or policy, then there could be efforts to use that to decide what's legitimate to study or to get funding for and all the rest. And I think we saw a lot of that. I mean, real sort of obvious bare partisanship around science, quite frankly, in the earlier years of the 20th century in the United States. And I think independent of one's politics, I think we can all agree there was a lot of political meddling in a way that we maybe hadn't been accustomed to seeing for quite so extreme ways in earlier times. So yeah, I think as I mentioned before, you know, I have some modest interest in following this kind of intelligent design or creationism stuff, partly just because it sometimes impacts, you know, ideas about cosmology or there's a kind of pushback around what I consider actually really very well-established ideas, and other people say, you know, that's just your opinion and you have no right to teach our children and all that kind of thing. And so, you know, that's still around. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how that settles out in the coming years.
One can't help but be reminded of Pat Robertson's rather disturbing comment about 10 years ago, where he said that UFO believers should be stoned, that the heavens are for God, the firmament is for man, yet he bounces the 700 Club off satellites all over the world.
Yes, right. That's right.
I guess you want your cake and you want to eat it too in that mm-hmm. regard. Where are we going now? I mean, what sort of breakthroughs? I know you have your own area of expertise in cosmology. Do you see anything on the near horizon that might be some just amazing breakthrough? Are there any areas that are particularly exciting right now in science?
Well, I think there are a lot of areas that are really exciting. You know, in my own little universe, so to speak, my own little domain, I think cosmology is in just an amazing place right now. You know, when I was starting out as a student not all that long ago, we could basically say with confidence that certain basic parameters of our universe were known to within a factor of 2, often to within a factor of 10. That's not very precise, right? And now a lot of the same parameters are known to better than 1% accuracy. I mean, they say better than 99% accuracy. The residual errors are incredibly small. And that's happened in the space of 10 or 20 years. And that has ruled out certain ideas, that has honed others, that's pushed new ideas to the forefront, and that's only sort of still building up steam. There are new satellites and incredible instruments being launched and designed all the time. So in that sense, I think cosmology is a growth area. I think it's incredibly exciting. We have these stubborn questions like dark matter, like dark energy, like all the exotic notions from Einstein's relativity we still haven't fully explored. And so there's plenty of room for really fun and intriguing stuff in cosmology, and that's just one area. I think lots of people would have similar excitement, you know, around, I say, nanotech or certainly quantum computing or all kinds of areas within the physical sciences.
Well, we have a new telescope going up, which I'm sure is real exciting for you and your work, the James Webb Telescope, which will be kind of the next generation Hubble. What do cosmologists and astrophysicists, what are they expecting to be able to determine that's new and exciting with this incredible leap forward in spaceborne technology?
So a lot of time with these satellites, you're worrying about increasing resolution on the sky. How finely can you distinguish between objects? And that's partly why the Hubble was such an amazing leap forward, to be able to see things that simply had not been seeable before. And the latest versions, like you say, should do that, you know, better by factors of 10 or 20 or 100. Same thing with these more cosmologically oriented satellites. There's a Planck satellite, named for Max Planck, you know, the quantum right. revolutionary. That's already in orbit. It's not reporting data yet, but it's taking data. And that, again, would do for understanding the very earliest moments of our universe, about, you know, 10 to 30 times better than the best we have today. And that's where you start being able to really say, is this how the universe began or is that? And you can really start distinguishing, instead of just saying, well, all our ideas are compatible with what we can know because we have fuzzed out data. You know, you really get down to the nitty gritty and you start getting surprises.
Well, also, there's a possibility of actually optically being able to see extrasolar planets as well.
Extrasolar, you know, astronomy, the exoplanet stuff is incredible and getting more so all the time. That's, you know, certainly aided by each of these leaps in technology. As well as, you know, peering, these things are your ultimate time machines. These are things are peering back in time of almost 14 billion years ago, and we can still take a Polaroid. You can take a snapshot of this baby universe and puzzle over it. That's pretty amazing.
So we're not going to be able to see all the way back to the Big Bang, obviously, but we're going to get pretty close, I would think, within probably less than a billion years, if memory serves me correct. And again, I am no scientist. Listeners, do not try this at home.
Right. In fact, we'll get back to roughly 400,000 years after the Big Bang, which is, say, about 13.7 billion years ago. It's a long time, 13.3 or so, yeah.
The big concern here is, of course, how all this cutting-edge research is being treated, especially now where we've reached the point here where, once again, science isn't getting the grants they used to get. We're so busy cutting spending, we don't think about the practical effect.
Well, that's true, and it is worrying. There are budget battles all the time. Our most recent budget battles have been more severe, of course, than average. And, you know, every now and then there are efforts to cut whole wings out of the National Science Foundation, just close them down, for example. And so far, at least, those battles have been more heat than light, and they were, I think, a lot of kind of political jockeying, but maybe not quite as serious a threat as it seemed, but who knows? And, you know, these days the congressional battles are just getting, quite frankly, more more difficult to understand, I'll put it that way, and just more and more uncertain. So, yeah, I think it is a difficult time now where, you know, cycle by cycle, you know, if there'll even be the foundation to apply for your grant, let alone will you get your grant, but will there even be the edifice there? And, again, so far it's made it through previous battles, but it's serious stuff.
In your particular case here, and obviously you're teaching the new generation of the scientists, the ones who will maybe figure out whether we can get a handle on time travel, on unlimited power, space travel, all this stuff. Do you find your classes getting bigger, smaller? What kind of things are they interested in?
They're pretty big, and I think they've gotten pretty big, and that's exciting. And these are, you know, incredibly, incredibly gifted, passionate, you know, students, with a lot more energy than I do, so that's a good thing. And so, you know, I think, for example, MIT graduated more physics majors this year than we have in something like 30 or more years. So that's clearly the trend is growing. Yeah,
Oh, that's excellent. That's good news.
Yep. Absolutely. I thought so.
Well, what are these kids, are they jazzed by anything in particular right now, or is it just go discipline by discipline, I suppose? I know there's a lot of interest in places like India and China are producing just amazing amounts of very, very talented scientists. I mean, you know, obviously this country has, you know, had a lead in all these ingenious scientists that you can point to in the past. Are we going to be losing our lead in the scientific disciplines because of the increased educational levels of these other countries? Do you think we're falling behind further and further, or are we holding our own? It sounds like there may be maybe some hope for this country. And you know, I think I mentioned on a prior show, I was taking some measurements to put a grill on a wall grating, and this 22-year-old kid, high school graduate, I asked him to write down some numbers for me, And I said, 33 and three quarters. And he said, what do you mean three quarters? And I said, well, it's 0.75. And he goes, well, what do you mean? How do you write that? And I literally almost fell off the ladder. I just could not believe that this high school graduate, 20-something-year-old kid, didn't know what a fraction was. It just boggled my mind.
It's not unusual. I've heard some of this, too. Yeah, let's do the break. David Kaiser joins us. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
You expect professional service from your doctor, your accountant, and even the girl who takes your morning coffee order. Why not from your domain registrar, too? Namecheap.com provides stellar service with no sneaky upselling. We offer more features and security options for your website than there are ways to order a latte. And new domains come with WhoisGuard to protect your personal info. At Namecheap.com, you can get your domain for as low as $2.99. Now is a great time to get to know Namecheap.com.
For 58 years, Fate has provided true reports to the strange and unknown. Fate brings you the latest in all aspects of the paranormal, like angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, and much, much more. To receive your complimentary Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
When making important financial decisions, you should always know the facts. That's why Midas Resources is willing to pay you to read the facts. Midas Resources, a team of hand-picked financial specialists with decades of financial experience who are ready to provide you with state-of-the-art, up-to-date financial services. Midas Resources offers a host of services and stands behind their products. In fact, if you call and order their free Midas report, Midas Resources will pay you. This detailed report will provide you with financial history on the safest and most profitable areas to invest in. If you read the report, Midas Resources will send you a free Walking Liberty silver half dollar. So what are you waiting for? Get the facts and call Midas Resources toll-free at 888-292-2709. That's 888-292-2709. And remember, if you read the Midas report, you'll receive a free Walking Liberty silver half dollar.
The food storage industry leader has done it again.
Introducing FDG Clubs and Survival Bucks from the Freeze Dry Guy. For over 39 years, the Freeze Dry Guy has served various government agencies and the private sector with the finest in storable foods and emergency rations. If you've wanted to build emergency food supplies but couldn't afford it, now you can. Go to freezedryguy.com, click on products, and look for the Freeze Dry Guy Clubs to pay as you go.
Now you can build food storage without going into debt.
Choose from a payment range of $95 to $450 per month.
Our clubs work with everyone's budget.
Plus, when you join Freeze Dry Guy Clubs, you'll get additional rewards. For example, this month, get 10% back in survival bucks on all purchases in the Freeze Dry Guy product line, plus free shipping within the lower 48 states on any order amount. Hurry. Go to freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-3663. That's freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-3663. The Freeze Dry Guy. The best you can buy.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We want to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com. Get in on all the action at forum.theparacast.com.
So consider that. Riddle me this. Is our knowledge of the basics of science, math, are we depending so much on the computers, the calculators, that we've lost some of our abilities? David Kaiser, I put that question to you.
You know, I, like most things, I think it's a mixed bag. I know many of my colleagues at MIT have worried very, very strongly about that, especially, say, in physics or in mathematics. Are students losing a kind of feel, a kind of intuition for the equations or for a order of magnitude? You know, if you're not doing a lot of hands-on stuff, if it's all just on a computer screen, do you have the same, feel for it? And, I've heard pretty convincing counter-arguments that the computers, can open up so many more things, enable these students to do in 10 minutes what a PhD would have had to spend a month doing before. So, like all things, I think it has the pros and cons. Certainly, it is the case that a lot of these students are such a computer wizard in a very powerful, productive way that they can just, I used to joke that, I have almost no programming skills at all, so I just hire, an 18-year-old to do it in 10 minutes. It would take me a semester to figure it out. So certainly there's a great amount of skill and real enthusiasm there that I think is a great good thing. Is that at the cost of, other ways or older ways of engaging with the material? Maybe, but I'm not sure it's a net loss. Maybe it's just different.
So we're still holding our own out there in the world with all these, China is graduating, I forget what the figure was, I think twice as many scientists basically than we are. Don't quote me on that one, but I remember reading an article and seeing the figure and just being like aghast that it seems like this country is slowly falling behind, but like you said, you've seen a real upsurge in interest in class sizes and bright kids coming up, so maybe there's hope, or are we going to continue falling further behind?
Well, I think there is hope. And, the numbers game is only part of it. What do those numbers represent? And again, there are, very, very world-class universities and scientists in China, for example, now training great, great people. But when you hear these numbers like 400,000 new graduates this year or that year, it takes a little more effort to sort of unpack what's the nature of that training? What are they doing with those skills? Just handing out degrees or just counting degrees, I should say, should be sort of the start of that discussion. And a lot of times I think that becomes the end of the discussion instead. And it actually harkens back to similar debates we had in this country during the Cold War, where was the Soviet Union graduating more physicists or engineers than we were, and if so, was that going to mean Armageddon? The numbers can become pretty political, and I think there's other questions or additional questions we're asking as well. So that's where I don't get quite as nervous. There are other indicators that certainly, obviously, the potential, the raw talent in places like China for science is growing rapidly. Look at the number of highly cited articles in the literature. Those things are growing very rapidly. So there are ways to say that things are changing. I don't think we're out of the count just yet.
We have to look also about what we need to do in the future to encourage this kind of research. Maybe cover more about what these guys are doing today in terms of their cutting-edge developments.
What are these guys up to now? We kind of talked a little bit about Jack Sarfati and I think Nick Herbert, but how about the other members of your fundamentalist physics group characters?
Sure. They've traveled lots of different roads. And so where they went from Berkeley was as sort of revealing to me, as interesting as what brought them there. So some of them have remained in sort of mainstream physics. So Henry Stapp has been a senior staff scientist this whole time at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, very well-respected kind of mainstream scientist with broad interests, and he's not afraid to ask uncomfortable questions about quantum theory and consciousness. But, he's had a paying job. He publishes in the right journals. He has a solid reputation within the field. John Clauser, the experimental physicist who did that very first laboratory test of Bell's theorem back in 1972, he also has done extremely well in terms of reputation. He just won this prestigious prize last year called the Wolf Prize in physics. He shared it with Anton Zeilinger and Alain Aspé from Paris, and that's often seen as a kind of, one step shy of the Nobel Prize, and really amazing, and I'd say very well-deserved recognition. On the other hand, he's never had a regular sort of academic position in physics his whole time. To this day, he runs a very sophisticated laboratory out of his garage, and he's able to get research funding grants from National Institutes of Health, for example, to do medical imaging. He's gotten patents sense, and he's a brilliant guy. He's incredibly productive, but he's had to make his own way, you know. Others still survive mostly or flourish on sort of, you know, private donations. I always joke that they're like Galileo in the Renaissance, like the De Medicis will pay them. They'll have their very wealthy, generous patrons. They'll do their work, and it'll be on, you know, on someone else's dime. And that sort of private patronage model has worked, you know, for some of these folks for a long time. And others, you know, became best-selling authors. They were able to live off their kind of royalties from the books that allowed them to keep these other flames going, keep the torch alive. And so certainly Fritjof Capra, you know, has been, I think, the most successful as an author of this group. He followed up the success of the Tao of Physics with a series of other books. He's still writing, he's still active. And I think, you know, some of those books became so wildly successful that, you know, commercially, that he was in a safe spot. And you know, Fran Allen Wolf and Nick Herbert have also been able to basically stay afloat or more so, largely on the basis of their writing. And then a few others became entrepreneurs. They started their own consulting companies. One of the founders of the group, George Weissman, actually began an import company for Tibetan herbal remedies for a while, that kind of thing. So they've been creative in other directions.
Yeah, brain tea.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all need some brain tea. Hey, that's an interesting question there about cutting-edge science. One of the things we're looking at are some ways to enhance our memory, and not just to deal with Alzheimer's or stuff like that, but enhance our memory, kind of make the gray matter more functional. Some people say we use only 10% of our brain power now. There was a movie out called Limitless where Bradley Cooper plays this character that he takes this injection and suddenly he's using 100% of his brain power. So is that real?
I don't know, but if it is, I'd like to know where to get some. It sounds like, you know, the new Planet of the Apes movie as well might be pretty similar in its premise, at least.
That's all about trying to deal with Alzheimer's, and a scientist tested on the ape. And that's the wrong thing to do, because the ape is played by Andy Serkis, who, of course, is known as Gollum in Lord of the Rings. It really is. He was the performance artist who actually created the first ape.
Oh, interesting. Well, how about Cowboys and Aliens? Have you seen that yet, Gene or David?
You know, I haven't. I saw the preview only. It looked like fun, but I haven't seen it.
It's interesting. You know, Andrew pointed out to me that if you kind of take an equation from what we consider to be the time period between the Big Bang and now, that some of the earliest planets, that suns, solar systems, have had about 9 billion years to get smart and to develop advanced spacefaring technology. Well, now he's saying, no. Here, why don't you say it?
Okay, so the universe is... Hi, everybody. The universe is 13.7 billion years old, give or take. We now know that the earliest stars started to shine a fraction of a billion years after the bang, about 360 million, I think it was. David would know for sure. It took us as Homo sapiens sapiens about 4 billion years to get smart from zero. And so you put it all together with the age of the universe, you could say that the oldest smart civilization that we could envisage would be about 9 billion years old. And that's quite an interesting number if you're interested in UFOs and that sort of thing, is it not?
In a sense, that would be enough of a time to sort of get here and back or something like that?
Or to, I don't know, totally manipulate entire galaxies. Who knows the level of technology that you could develop in that amount of time. I think Michio Kaku came up with a rating system of sophistication and ability to, I guess, impact their reality. And
we'll go into
the
rating system and the reality. David Kaiser joins us. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Graphic Converter is the image manipulation tool for the rest of us. It does not use any database. You get full control of all your files. Want to view the images of a folder? Drag it into Graphic Converter and a powerful browser opens up to show your image files. You could use it for slideshows. You could use it to import images from digital cameras or from scanners. Need to do some image editing? You can do that too in Graphic Converter. Also print catalogs. Convert from so many formats I can't even list them. Download now to see if Graphic Converter is good for you, like 1.5 million other users. Guess what? You could save money when you buy Graphic Converter. Use the coupon code NIGHTOWL. Use the coupon code NIGHTOWL to get a special price for Graphic Converter. Go to LemkeSoft.com. That's LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com.
Attention gardeners, this is an urgent GCN self-reliance update. GCN has just discovered a new bioactive superfood for garden plants, flowers, and herbs. It's called ProtoGrow, and it's so effective at producing rapid plant growth that it seems to almost force plants to grow like crazy under practically any soil and light conditions. Now, here's the best part for our listeners who garden for self-reliance. ProtoGrow's unique blend of sea nutrients maximizes mineral uptake and dramatically increases bloom set, creating maximum plant growth in minimum time. ProtoGrow works by providing geometric keys, which have the capacity to actually unlock the genetic code for nutritional uptake in plants. ProtoGrow's full-spectrum plant fertility means fruits and vegetables with extraordinary taste and up to 10 times the nutritional value. And if you want to double or triple the potency of herbs or wheatgrass, you can. If you want to grow nutritionalized superfoods with non-hybrids, it's now easy. GCN listeners who want to grow dirt-cheap superfoods should visit the ProtoGrow website at growlikecrazy.com. That's www.growlikecrazy.com or call 877-327-0365. That's 877-327-0365.
If you drive for a living, you don't get paid to stop or wait in line. Keep your wheels moving with PrePass. Bypass way stations. Fly by port of entry facilities. Stay moving at highway speed while the guy without PrePass waits in line. Save time, save money. Call 888-401-PASS to try PrePass free. That's 888-401-PASS.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
You know that drinking pure, high-alkaline water is one of the most important factors in maintaining high energy and vibrant health, and most experts agree that the water you drink should be at a pH level of 8 or higher. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops, available only at AlkaVision.com, combine a unique formula of most alkaline minerals available. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops alkalize your water, ridding the body of harmful toxins and acid, helping you to regain your energy and health. Alkalizing your water by simply adding 10 drops of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops helps the body to rid itself of acidic waste, increases oxygen, and raises the pH of your body to optimal levels. And bacteria and viruses cannot survive in an alkaline high pH environment. Order your bottle of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops for only $29.95 at AlkaVision.com. That's AlkaVision.com. Or call 269-409-1776. 269-409-1776. Alkalize your body. Supercharge your health at AlkaVision.com.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Hi, this is Ted Phillips, listening to the Paracast, and it's as good as it gets, believe me.
We continue with David Kaiser, last two segments exploring cutting edges of science and what all those hippies did. I'm Gene Steinberg. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. So the question here, could we have today a group of 2011 hippies who maybe even now are trying to figure out what science will be like for the next 50 years?
I think we could. You know, I end the book in the epilogue by saying this, I think there's a wider safety net this time around than in the 70s for people, for ideas that are just a little bit further from mainstream. There are whole institutes, they're kind of brick and mortar institutes that are devoted to ideas like the foundations of quantum theory, quantum cosmology, and all the rest. There are also sort of internet-based funding agencies, for lack of a better word, so they're not even face to face, but there are, you know, private donations that can then be parceled out. There's a group called FQXI, the Fundamental Questions Institute, and they give grants, basically, you know, modest sized grants to people, some of whom are university professors, others of whom are independent scholars, is the kind of euphemism for folks on their own. And, you know, there's a way to get that stuff, to keep the people asking the questions, to make sure they're not really, kind of lost. And also, of course, in the internet age, to get the stuff to circulate. So a lot of garbage can circulate on the internet. There's no, way to stop that. But it's not impossible to get ideas circulating and bouncing off other folks and interacting there too. So I think there is room for groups like the one I wrote about these days, and they might not be quite as have quite as hard a time as it, quite frankly, you know, getting resources, getting the word out, finding, meeting up, even if only in cyberspace, with like-minded folks. And so, yeah, I think that continues.
Andrew has a question here. Hold on.
Yeah, there's been a recent paper. I wanted you to comment on it, if you possibly could, on the fundamentals of quantum mechanics. And I do, please excuse me, I cannot remember the full names of the authors. But there's a Stephanie X, very attractive young lady from Australia, I think it is, and a chap from Cambridge, again, whose name I don't remember. And the title of the paper is something like Non-Locality and Quantum Uncertainty. And essentially, they found a very deep connection. This was published only in the last 3 to 6 months on Archive. Whether it will make it to PhysRev D letters or something, I don't know. But it was called Non-Locality and Quantum Uncertainty, relating non-locality to Heisenberg's uncertainty. Now, it's a very deep result, which seems to have been well received. I wonder if you would comment on it. Do you think it's pushed the field of understanding the roots of quantum mechanics further forward for us, if you're familiar with it?
Well, unfortunately, you know, I don't know this paper in particular, so I can't say either way. But it's certainly an example of this notion that there are now lots and lots of people all over the world who are, you know, concerned, as members of this group that I write about were concerned in the past, with this sort of deep structure, the deep foundations of quantum theory. And nowadays, you know, one can get those papers published more readily. They can circulate pretty easily. So I don't know this particular one, but it's an example of that kind of activity that really has a kind of foothold back at the table again. It's no longer kind of laughed out of court as an activity, you know.
Yeah, it almost sounds like we're getting to a point where we're starting to see unification of theories that tend to be almost like we're reweaving the strands of the rope, and we're starting to really get closer to some fundamental science at the core, you know, the connecting point between a lot of these questions. And, you know, just the whole idea of the CERN project and the Large Hadron Collider and the success that they've had, I think now they're going to go up to full power, if I'm not mistaken. In about a year. What? Any ideas of what we could expect from a full power test and colliding particles at CERN?
Well, I mean, so again, one is certainly to be hoped for is really definitive evidence, if it's to be had, for this Higgs boson, or we talked about before, this one sort of missing character, one central but yet as yet unseen piece of the puzzle in how,
yeah, the,
you know,
God
matter
particle
holds together, so-called, yes. So that is, I'd say, a pretty likely to be hoped for development. And then, you know, all kinds of things. So it could be there are reasons to suspect that one might be able to catch real evidence for extra dimensions through exotic ways that particles would behave, momenta would be measured, and so on in these exotic interactions. So all of a sudden, the LHC could, it's a long shot, but it's not impossible, could be telling us about, you know, the most basic structure of space-time, even beyond the sort of little particles that dance around within it. Or in an exciting but maybe a little bit more mundane way, it could hopefully be finding candidates for this dark matter stuff, particles of the sort we've never seen before, perhaps because we never were looking at the right energy scale until we're able to now, or signs for other kind of exotic symmetries or notions about what governs these subatomic forces that have so far really only been hypothesized, and there's been no solid evidence really either way for decades. And so a lot of people are excited, saying we should, no matter what we find, it'll be new, it'll be beyond what we already know, and a lot of them could be very, you know, very loaded pointers. They could say it's really this road and not the other one for moving forward.
In every era that we study science, we kind of think we've got it pretty well under control now. We know kind of what's going on with the universe, and then 50 years later, they seem like a bunch of Neanderthals. You know, we find out that every
quite go that
piece
far,
of
Gene, but
pardon?
Maybe Homo sapien, not without the sapien. Man,
whatever,
the wise,
the
wiser.
The point being that we all tend to think that we have a handle on what's happening in science, and then we find something else that shows, hey, we barely knew what was going on. So do you think there's a point where we could ever know all that there is to know? It's kind of a simplistic question, but one that people do ask.
And I think the answer is no. And I think for the reason you were saying before, I think you're right that we have been, I would say, surprised and maybe humbled. Maybe we haven't been humbled enough given what we should have been. You know, time, like you say, time and time again, you don't have to go back all that far. So it's not often, it's not only that we find out we were sort of wrong about something we deeply believed and dearly held, but then most of what we were worried about was sort of becomes irrelevant. I mean, it's not neither right nor wrong so much as the wrong question to be asking. It's that kind of upheaval that really does happen. It happens every few decades, if not, centuries, that kind of scale at the very least. And, on the one hand, that's incredibly exciting. On the other hand, you say, well, what are we worrying about so deeply now that it might turn out to be a non-problem? Not that we'll solve it. It just won't even be a problem anymore when seen from the vantage point of some new later set of ideas. So, yeah, I mean, it's, I wouldn't want to be the one saying, we've got it. We're done. I don't think that was ever going to be a winning position.
That reminds me of the head of the U.S. Patent Office in the late 1890s and the famous quote that everything that can be invented has been invented. So,
Lord, so I always wonder about the 6,000 patents that Apple and some other companies just bought because they were newly invented. But I won't get into the situation here whether patents are being granted for trivial inventions or such broad-based inventions that, of course, anybody is in violation. That gets to be almost ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But, let's go back, since we mentioned Einstein, and now a lot of people looking to go beyond Einstein, and maybe he says, of course, the speed of light is supposedly the maximum, but we can find tricks around that. So after all these years, how good was Einstein's vision?
Well, I'd say it was awfully good. And so Einstein, it turns out, was human. He was wrong a lot of the time, like every other human ever has been. And I don't think that's a great fault of his to have to admit that. On the other hand, just about a century later, coming up on a century since general relativity, well over a century since special relativity, coming up on a century in quantum theory, I mean, we're still living in many ways in Einstein's world. And we still think about things largely in ways that he had encouraged or taught us to. And there aren't many other people for whom we can say that. That's an amazing accomplishment. There we've been able to find things in his ideas that he hadn't even anticipated, but that the structure, the fabric was there, and it's led us to discover even new things that were kind of latent. And, it's he wasn't right about every last thing. No one is. But what he gave us has been well worth it. It's been an astonishing picture, and I think actually a very exciting one.
So much to learn. So little time. David Kaiser's our guest. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
So here's what happened. I was placing an order online. The site went down. It just stopped responding. It took hours before it returned, but I had already placed the order with another company. If your site goes down, you could lose business. And if you have a business or personal site, you'll want to know it's easy to run and it will stay online. At iWeb, your site is hosted on one of the most reliable networks in the world. Check it out. iWeb.com. That's iWeb.com. For 58 years, Fate has provided true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate brings you the latest in all aspects of the paranormal, like angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, and much, much more. To receive your complimentary Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Big Berkey water filters are in high demand. Storable foods are also in high demand. BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com has always kept our focus on the Berkey water filter products, but increasingly, our customers have been asking for storable foods. After months of research, BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com now offers great-tasting, long-lasting, storable foods. These ready-to-eat meals are packed in airtight nitrogen pouches. All you do is just add water, and because they're sealed so well, they come with a 25-year shelf life. Combine our Berkey water filters, which are powerful enough to purify treated, untreated, or even stagnant pond water with our storable foods, and you have a winning combination. Remember, we offer free shipping on every order over $50, and GCN listeners receive 5% off all ceramic filter systems. Visit Big, B-E-R-K-E-Y, waterfilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY. That's Big Berkey, waterfilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY today.
Congratulations to our friends at eFoodsDirect.com. In August, they celebrate 30 years in the long-term storable food business. To celebrate, eFoodsDirect.com is offering the lowest price ever on their one-year Freedom Food Supply, even less than the price in 1981. For a limited time, you get 30% off a one-year Freedom Supply, which provides three hearty meals per day for one adult. The Freedom Supply includes a large variety of fruits and vegetables, dairy, legumes, grains, sprouting seeds, and more. Plus, you get a generous supply of their quick-fix meals. This is the most complete, extensive, and affordable unit they have ever offered. Call 800-409-5633 or go to eFoodsDirect.com/Alex and get 30% off a one-year food supply. If you have ever considered getting a supply, now is the time. Call 800-409-5633. That's 800-409-5633 or eFoodsDirect.com/Alex.
Fight back this cold and flu season with the world's best garlic extract, Ali-C. Why Ali-C? Because it helps your body fight viruses, bacteria, and fungi. Ali-C has been scientifically proven in double-blind studies using low doses to greatly reduce the number, severity, and duration of common colds. Ali-C contains 300 milligrams of stabilized allicin, the active ingredient in crushed garlic. Studies show Ali-C is effective against MRSA, bacterial, fungal, and viral infections. One tablet of Ali-C has the equivalent of 40 cloves of garlic. Ali-C supports your body's resistance to all types of conditions and can help lower high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So boost your body's resistance to infection with nature's best garlic extract, Ali-C. For more information and to order Ali-C, call 877-888-7126 or go to garlichealthproducts.com. That's 1-877-888-7126 or go to garlichealthproducts.com for your Ali-C today.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Hi, my name is Richard Dolan. You're listening to the Paracast.
We're back. One more session with David Kaiser. I'm Gene Steinberg. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. Chris, does your friend have any more questions?
Yeah, Andrew.
David, I think there's a sort of a paradigm that's rather a bit meta about physics. You know, is physics fashion? By that, I mean this. If you really widen it out to extra dimensions found by the LHC. If you say that I have something that's even deeper than Emmy-Noether's symmetry theorem, which says that for every conservation law there's a corresponding symmetry principle, absolutely, fundamentally deep thing to say about the universe. Somebody comes along next week and says, well, I can actually go deeper than Emmy-Noether and say something much more fundamental than that, you know, which sort of like undercuts the what we call the fundamentals and goes even deeper and sets out a substrate upon which a lot more things can be understood. It renders Newton even more archaic. It renders Einstein passé and so forth. It seems to me that we do have this sort of fashionable aspect of physics, which, you know, is our current the zeitgeist of general relativity and quantum mechanics. Do you really think that zeitgeist has got any sense of true permanence in a large sense? Fast forward 500 years and look at the exponential rate of the increase of knowledge. Do we really believe that QM and GR will be around as paradigms in, say, 500 years, Dan?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the answer is no, but that's not a reason for despair, at least as I see it. In the sense that, you know, we still teach our students Newton's mechanics, right? That's, you know, not 500 years since Newton, but several hundred. And so we no longer think the universe runs exactly as Newton had taught us, but the way of analyzing things we can observe that Newton had bequeathed is still unbelievably helpful and powerful, and our newer ideas have to, you know, kind of incorporate those results even as they move beyond them. And I think that is likely to be what's going to happen with both quantum mechanics and general relativity. I don't think either of them is necessarily the final word, certainly general relativity. There are all kinds of reasons from within the structure of general relativity to say this probably isn't everything, right? This might be pointing to where it itself might break down. But any other, the next grander, more amazing, strange concoction is likely to incorporate at least the things that we have really wrestled with hard about Einstein's relativity. So those might not be any more the fundamental, bedrock answer for why things behave the way they do, but it would be a pretty good account for why they do. We might have a kind of underneath reasoning that would, on which that would rest, much like we'd say with, say, Newton's laws today or Maxwell's equations for electricity and magnetism. And we still, MIT students still all the time will buy T-shirts with Maxwell's equations on the front, which I love. They always wear them to my class. And, we'd say, oh, Maxwell's equations. We now know about quantum theory and electrons and charges, things that Maxwell didn't even know about. And yet the equations are both worth putting on a T-shirt and worth teaching for semesters at a time because they're incredibly powerful and they've captured something about the world, even if they're not the final word.
So, I mean, indeed. I mean, we have these incredible checks and balances web in place now that just wasn't there 100 years ago. So every new thing that we posit has to pass all the tests that we've thought of since that time, and as we go on in time, would you not agree that the checks and balances are a very, very good guide to where to go next? But I see also a dark side to that. Do you not also that perhaps it might be inhibitory in terms of making large leaps?
Well, I see what you mean. And so that was part of what I was interested in writing this book, actually, is, when does the mainstream rule out questions as somehow, outré, as not questions worth asking? I think that becomes dangerous. I do think that's right. Or at least, I wouldn't want to see that. That can be overdone. And that's where I think groups like the one I wrote about in Berkeley in the 70s, they were no longer beholden to those kind of, we might say, fashions or the opinions of the mainstream. They carved out this parallel universe and then kind of crawled back in. That level of the out-of-the-box thinking that I think is better supported now than back then. That's where I say there's a wider safety net now for ideas that are not necessarily, in that sense, fashionable or going along with what most people already believe. We have, I think, really good reasons to believe what we do, but let's not lose sight of the fact that these are likely to be upended, or at least could be upended as well. And so in that sense, I think you're right, that there can be a kind of taste question. That doesn't smell like a good topic, don't work on it. And that, I think, could be a very difficult situation to overcome for young scientists starting out.
Let me just ask a fast question here as we're getting to the tail end of this program. And that is false research. We hear about it occasionally where people either claim to have scientific credentials or don't, or they falsify the research. They try to take shortcuts. How do you have checks and balances in the system to overcome this tendency?
You're right, and it happens, I would say, at least as much now as in other periods from any way that it's hard to get good measures on the frequency of these things, but there is reason to believe it. We haven't licked that system. I think we can understand some of the motivations for why it happens, and those motivations are probably not going to go away anytime soon. It has to do with things like, like we talked about before. Well, ego, but also, I would say, even more mundane, difficulty getting research grants, the kind of rat race of trying to get the resources you need to ask the hard questions. There can certainly be temptations to cut corners. That obviously doesn't make it right. It also can make it pretty hard to catch. I mean, people will say, oh, we'll just rely on peer review. Peer review, of course, is fallible. There was that famous case from just about a decade ago at Bell Labs where a young researcher had to retract, I think, at least 20 articles that were published not just in any old peer-reviewed journals, but in Science, Nature, Physical Review Letters, the most prestigious, most carefully vetted journals on the planet. And these were not one or two, but I think on the order of 20 of them that were formally retracted, something like that. So it's not, peer review is important, but that's not the panacea either. So I think, we can understand the part of the kind of sociology behind how it might happen. And, quite frankly, I don't have a good answer other than, obviously peer review, obviously careful vetting and a kind of openness in data sets and all that, which might go some part of the way. But I don't think we're going to lick it. I think that's I don't think it's a huge problem. I don't want to exaggerate saying it's behind every corner. But it's there and it hasn't gone away.
And by the same token, the availability of grants in certain areas of research that kind of precludes other areas, unless there's a bunch of hippies sitting in a coffee shop in San Francisco and thinking about the future.
Well, I mean, this goes back to this question of fads and fashions. And, you know, there are kind of tastemakers in science, believe it or not. And so you're right. You want to make sure that those are not sort of really cutting off ideas or people who obviously have things to contribute, even if they might not be in that same direction.
Well, what's in the future for you? I'm sure this book is being well received. And do you have any other books in the works or any other literary projects that you're working on? Or what's on your event horizon now?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, on the physics side, I'm indeed still working on the cosmology and actually trying to play with an idea that might combine the Higgs boson with a modification of Einstein's relativity to understand the early universe. I don't think it's the best answer, but it's intriguing. And then in terms of books, you know, there's a project I'm working on that I've been really enjoying. It's a political history of Einstein's gravity. Let's understand general relativity as, like these hippies, as always embedded in times and place. The people who are spending their lives studying it are, you know, interrupted by war, they're involved in the Cold War, they're involved in all kinds of things. And it's a way of understanding, you know, science and context in a very kind of immediate, personal way. And that stretches over really the entire 20th century. So that's a book I've actually really been enjoying as well. Another book on sort of the politics of science policy and how do we handle things like challenges from either the Soviet Union or more recently China and India about these, numbers of degrees granted per year and that kind of thing. How does that shape what we think science should be like or what we want to train our students to do? So that's another book that I'm chipping away.
Well, excellent, worthy topics. Much luck and success. And again, if those books are anything like How the Hippies Save Physics, I'll be reading them. That's for sure. I really did enjoy the book. And you know, it was really kind of you to come on a lowly paranormal show and talk some science. And I was very grateful to have Andrew Palfrem in here, who was quite the scientist in his own right. And it's been a real pleasure, David. And thank you so much for being on the show. And I think Gene will agree that this is going to be an exciting episode, and we're going to generate quite a bit of banter, I'm sure, on the Paracast forums, which is located at forum.theparacast.com for all you. Future posters. Let's get a thread going on this show. This is going to be a lot of fun.
The book, of course, is called How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. The guest has been David Kaiser, professor at MIT. David, thanks for joining us this week on the Paracast.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate your invitation.
The Paracast, featuring Gene Steinberg and Christopher O'Brien, is a copyrighted presentation of Making the Impossible, Incorporated. Tune in next week for a new adventure in The Paracast.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you own an Apple iPhone and love to listen to your favorite programs on GCN, I've got good news for you. I'm proud to announce that GCN has a brand new iPhone app available for our dedicated listeners at GCNLive.com. Listen to your favorite hard-hitting GCN programs live or on demand right on your iPhone. And the best part? The GCN iPhone app can be yours absolutely free. Download the iPhone app today by clicking on the banner at GCNLive.com. Again, that's GCNLive.com.
We the people grow cotton, weave fabric, engrave ink, embed strips and fibers to protect from counterfeit, then carting to a private bank, having it lent back at interest, forcing taxes to service debt. This capitalism, or was Jefferson correct when stating a central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army? Ted Anderson, I'm placing a free silver dollar in a book that explains our monetary system. Call for your copy, 800-686-2237. It's time to understand the system. Call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.